everyone. Welcome to episode 6. That's right. We have a 6-pack of episodes for Behind the Science of Career Development. My name is Dr. Brian Hutchison, aka the Global Career Guy. I am the editor of the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal, and this is our companion podcast where we really get into fun, deep, interesting, and insightful conversations about the science behind our field of career development. A quick programming note, as you may have heard in the most previous 2 episodes, we are mixing it up a little bit this year. We're looking for a wide range of conversations and guests to really push our thinking about this field, not only its past, but also the things that we want to think about in the future. I'm super excited to bring on board an old colleague that I've known for many years and that I don't know, I think we probably haven't spoken in at least 3 or 4 years. But today I'm with Dr. Sarah Patterson Mills of Lindenwood University. And instead of me trying to give the bio I think you would want, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Sarah?
Certainly. Glad to be here. And Brian, I don't know about how I feel about old.
Old friends, not old people. Not old people. Although
I just want to clarify for everybody, you know.
Yeah, although I might need to consider some hair color after I finally get a cut post-pandemic because exactly. It is getting gray.
Same here. So yeah, great to be here. I am a former school counselor, former current LPC in Missouri, and I have had a lot of different experiences in ranging from, you know, inpatient settings to K-12 settings. Currently, I am the assistant dean of our newly renamed Human Services College at Lindenwood, which is going to contain behavior analysis, social work, and counseling. So we're kind of the clinical arm of things, and I've been doing this since last August. So I've entered this role, which I've never been in before. I was a professor. So I entered this role in a pandemic with 3 kids, one of which is elementary. So we're dealing with the virtual K-12 scenarios and all that fun stuff. So anyway, Jeez. That brings me to today.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're coming to us underneath some duress or maybe looking to get away from it all for a couple of minutes.
Hence the gray hair. Yeah. Yes.
So
yes.
Yeah, one of the things that I've always admired about you, Sarah, is that so you've named all of these sort of backgrounds and specialty areas, but similar to what I try to be, you've really made career development sort of like the lens through which you've looked through your work as a school counselor, a mental health counselor.
Very true.
And now as an administrator, could you talk a little bit about your passion for career development and why it lights your fire?
Career development, initially, I've got to be honest, I had to take career counseling, right? We're all required to take it. And I thought, I don't think I'm ever going to use this. And then I realized in every setting, I'm using career counseling in schools. We're doing planning, post-secondary transitions in mental health settings and working with Voc Rehab and some of these other agencies that dovetail with services that I've been able to provide over the years. It really is all encompassing. And not only that, from a personal standpoint, really understanding how work and life blend together are so incredibly interesting to me. So the different developmental phases we all go through in life and lifespan changes, all of that is really impacted through this lens of work.
Yeah. And you are so singing my song right now. Absolutely. You know, I keep meaning to do this. So I'm still part of a private practice in St. Louis, even though I'm remote now.
Nice. Uh-huh.
And so I do a lot of clinical supervision. I probably see almost 100 case notes a week.
Wow.
And I keep meaning to just do a rough count of what percentage of all clinical mental health clients are looking to address career concerns as part of their therapy.
Absolutely.
My gut tells me it's got to be close to 50%, if not over.
Yes.
Particularly over time, because so much is intersecting between career and work.
Right. And it's funny, I started the Career Center when we had a campus over in Belleville. And what we found was really a mixed model worked better, but administration always wanted us to differentiate between the two for the numbers so that they would have how many students are we seeing that are career students and how many are clinical mental health students. And there really was, it became very difficult to tease those apart.
Yeah. I tell my students to this day, I don't train career counselors anymore. I train all counselors to be able to effectively address career concerns in school counseling, marriage and family, which is always present, clinical mental health counseling, and beyond. I think the field needs to be given the same treatment with career as it was effectively given with multicultural counseling in the last 50 years.
Absolutely.
A blended infused model and its importance in everything that we do.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, you're
can't
here
argue
today.
With that.
Oh, yes. Oh, we could argue. That would make a great podcast. No, they probably don't want to hear us argue. So speaking of not arguing, I don't remember the year. I don't remember the place, but I remember the conversation with you quite a while ago where we were talking about the importance of naming and giving credit to the women in the early part of our profession's development. So I always thought of it as, I think, the first 50 or 60 years of career development as a profession, how we've sort of silenced that history professionally, and that might have some implications for the way that we think about and do our work today. Would you mind if we kicked it off? I know that you've been doing a research project, and at the end, we'll talk about how people can access that. But could we start off with just you telling us the story of one of the women that you've been researching early on, and maybe a favorite story of yours?
I've got a couple. It's going to be hard to pick just a couple, one or two out of those. But I would say that, surprisingly, this whole journey started for me with Jane Addams, and a lot of folks don't associate her with career. But one of the things that I started reading about early on was I looked to where could I find information about women that impacted our field. And so I thought, what about the Red Cross? That's an idea, because isn't that mostly women who work in the Red Cross? And so I started out.
And so just to clarify, because this is the Asia Pacific Career Development Association, and I'm not aware of all the countries. I think the Red Cross is international and known all across the world, but just in case not, could you just give us a quick primer on the role the Red Cross played at that time?
Sure. So the Red Cross provided nursing care. Initially, I believe it was during the war. They collect blood. And the other piece to them was that later, around the 1900, right after 1900, they started doing these home visits, and they would have nurses sent out, tuberculosis nurses and maternal nurses, for lack of a better word, who would go and check on the babies and make sure that neonatal care was being followed up on. And so they had a variety of services similar to what we would almost call social work today, or medical social work types of counseling and consulting. But they were really in the trenches, literally at war, and they were literally in the trenches going through settlement houses and tenement housing and helping to guide and coach families, mainly moms, on how to raise their kids hygienically.
And so this is a role that Jane Addams had and is more broadly known for, doing that kind of work?
Well, she started out with kind of the similar home visits. And so she wasn't necessarily affiliated with the Red Cross, but from my Red Cross reading, her name populated because her trekking across the city of Chicago, if you can imagine, she's a woman of privilege, around 1900, a little before, and then of course after, she wrote so many books, developed that settlement house. But the reason that she developed her settlement house was so that she could provide services for immigrants. And as we had a flood of immigrants around 1900 moving to the cities because of industrialization, that second industrialization movement with all the factories, she was very alarmed at child labor conditions, women's labor conditions, and particularly those that were immigrants. And also this idea later that, why aren't these kids in school? Why is crime going up?
Yeah.
So she literally just dug in. And put herself out there to talk with these folks. So
I always talk to people. I mean, it's important, I think, to remember in our day-to-day context that we're probably only about six generations away from elementary age children working in some of the most dangerous work conditions in the world of work at that time, in factories, in mines, and doing that sort of work. And then I was talking to someone on another podcast. My grandmother never drove a car. or had her own checking account, because we're probably only four generations or five from women still being largely viewed as property of husbands in society and not having any sense of full rights. And so I think that there's so many things that we think about today where we, if we lose that history, we're doing a lot of clients, in this case, I would think female clients, a great disservice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another fun one that's been mentioned. So Anna Reid.
Oh.
Yeoman Reid, Y-E-O-M-A-N. Mm-hmm. She's pretty interesting. And I actually tried to request information. She's a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, mm-hmm. one of the original members. So her, whatever it was, grandfather, great-grandfather, was originally Northeastern and fought in the Revolutionary War. She literally moved across the country. And if you think about 1910, it would be very brave, I think, for a woman on her own, unmarried, to travel across the country like that, all the way out to Seattle.
Wow.
And then she did a whole lot more traveling where she gathered tons and tons of data and statistics on working conditions out west. So, and she actually was in the Seattle Vocational Bureau as well. So later asked to lead, I believe it was a child labor for the state of Washington. So here's this woman, and she did get married at some point. And you know, that's another thing when I'm doing research, I think, why is it important that they're married or not? Would we be asking that if it were Parsons or you know, Bloomfield, would we be saying, hey,
Meyer Bloomfield? Yeah.
Were you guys married? Well, and so I've caught myself a few times with my own biases too.
Absolutely. Well, because even as a woman, you're being raised in the male dominated system, right? Like the default perspective is male. So if we tie this together a little bit, so Parsons is a name that almost any listener will know, right? Mm-hmm. The original vocational bureau through the Settlement House in Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
I believe most of the other instructors in the vocational bureau were women in Boston. But then we had these other models that opened up across the United States in the early 1900s. And I know that Dr. Stephanie Burns did a great article on the women that did the Cincinnati Vocational Bureau.
Edith Abbott, I believe it was, and Woolley.
Yep, absolutely. And then, and so then you're bringing up Jane Addams, who opened did the Settlement House in the Vocational Bureau in Chicago. And then, I'm sorry, I just lost the name of the person in Seattle.
Anna Reid.
This is why you're the expert and I'm the host, right? Yeah. And so really, everyone knows Frank Parsons' name that goes to any type of structured career development training, coaching programs, counseling programs, vocational psychology programs.
Well, he's the father, right?
Yeah, the father. But it was the mothers that were spreading this thing across the country for the most part.
Yes, I believe that to be the case. Even if we talk about Jesse B. Davis,
mm-hmm.
who was
Jesse
our
B.
first...
Jesse B. Davis, the first school counselor.
In
the 1890s, absolutely.
And so they had really a recognition for him. 1913 was when they held their National Vote Guidance Association meeting. They had an Ann Davis from Chicago, mm-hmm. who was doing a lot with vocational education in the K-12 setting. I believe Reid was not at that meeting. I'm trying to think, there was one other. It's in my most recent article that I'm submitting that'll come out next month, I believe, in the Career Convergence magazine. But there were several present at that meeting that were kind of preaching the same thing. And so honestly, they couldn't have just come up with that idea, you know, at the same time or after they talked with him. They had to have been working on it because they had been laying groundwork back from wherever they came from to this meeting. So it's kind of interesting how things get attributed to certain people.
Yeah. And, you know, so when I think about all the facets of my work, from being a practitioner to being a researcher to scholar, you know, advocate, I feel like social media has really taken me to another level of being plugged in to women today, talking about this same phenomena of being like, I don't know if erased is the right word. It feels like the right word, but like present, major contributor, not seen or heard or not promoted. Could you talk a little bit about why it's important for us to understand this past so that we can be more effective advocating for female clients in the present?
Absolutely. I think that this all leads into some themes that happened then, but I think are equally weighty now. And in terms terms of what you just described, the social networking, you know, we have to keep in mind of when this all happened, there wasn't really social networking the way we think of it, but these women were able to really social network long distance. And so that a lot of them were very connected. And I think that perhaps their networks might have been more closed in that light to some of our male folks that were pioneers in the field.
So were they writing letters, or how were they connecting from so far apart?
You know, it was funny. A lot of them met at teachers' colleges.
Oh.
So Columbia or Wellesley are the two big ones. Then a few of them started out at Chicago, University of Chicago, and met there. Talbot and McLean were two that were really prominent. And one of the, there's two Abbotts. There's Edith Abbott and her sister. And so they both were intermingled in all of this work. Grace was more of the activist, and Edith was more of the academic.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it's just interesting that they were connecting at these little nexus places, and the settlement houses was one. And so what emanated from those settlement houses was one of the first work-life balance support groups, really. But anyway, I think part of what happened was they're networking with each other because that's who they had for support. And they weren't always readily admitted into the male rooms where they were having conversations that then get written down and attributed to the history. So
I have to go back.
Okay.
You're educating me. The first work-life balance groups. Can you tell me a little bit more about like who was attending, what the structure of those was?
That was exactly something that I noted when I went. But when I started studying Jane Addams, I had the opportunity to go to Hull House or Chicago, and I said, we're going.
And so Hull House is
her settlement in Chicago. Thank you for asking. And so we, being my entire family, because I told my daughters, we're going. I have three daughters and a husband. And I said, we're all going to the Hull House. And you're going to understand, like, the contributions that this woman made were just enormous. And so I think that was a day my then three or four-year-old decided to just have, like, a meltdown. Like, it was during nap time in the afternoon or something. And I thought, oh, my goodness gracious, I can hear my daughter crying in the Hull House upstairs. She's downstairs. Then she got on the swing and fell off the swing, which was indoors. And I just kind of smiled and thought Jane Addams would have been totally used to this because she had a whole city block full of kids and immigrant mothers, and later opened it up to men as well. But one of the things that she started very early to notice is that people were very stressed because of the long work day. The immigrant population couldn't communicate. So that's stressful enough. Think about going to another country when you can't speak the language. And that doesn't mean talk louder. It means you have to understand the language to feel less distressed. So anyway, she noticed all these things and started having kind of a communal talk after dinner, 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock hour after dinner. And they would be each other's support for what are you stressed about? I'm sure the language was way different, but basically what are you stressed about and how can we best support each other to get through this? So essentially that was the first work-life balance group that I've come across. That was right around 1900. So
it's amazing. And it makes me think of two parallels, I think, for our current time. So I've worked a lot with immigrants in the last 10 years of my career, teaching at institutions that are primarily first and second generation immigrant students, and then with the International Institute quite a bit in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one is the unique needs of immigrants during the pandemic, and the fact that they're more likely to be in positions, including immigrant mothers, to have to still go out and work in this unsafe world without proper protection, are more stressed by the financial concerns because of either mistrust of federal or state systems or not being eligible for some of the systems of support that we've enacted on the short-term basis. But then I'm curious about the other side of that coin. I mean, you were talking to me at the beginning, but I think before we got on air, about being at home with your three kids. There's an excellent opportunity for non-immigrant, just women in the United States, to really sort of reflect on the impact of these phenomena like the pandemic on working women. And we're seeing the data that working women are being pruned out of the workforce in great numbers right now by the pandemic.
Yes,
if I were a better host, there'd be a question in there, but maybe you could just reflect on all of the jibber jabber that I just said to you.
Sure. Let me see if I can make sense of that. No, I'm kidding. It feels like, and this is just my personal experience and from what I've heard from colleagues and friends, it feels like you're you're responsible for the house again in greater demand than you were before. So we had the 80s and we had Mr. Mom and we had, you know, some of those other movies where men started helping more, right? Which means they're not actually responsible. They're just helping, mm-hmm. which is a whole different issue. Great so point. Men are helping more and it feels that way now. Like we've kind of regressed because God loved technology, but now I can sit in my house, have my three kids, have my animals I have to take out, make dinner. Like I'm right here by the kitchen. Why doesn't it make sense that I should, and it doesn't make sense since I'm home, it should be clean. So there's all these things that are being added constantly to your plate, interruptions. So people with real young kids I've talked to have said the interruptions, it interrupts workflow. Mm-hmm. And so our disrupted workflow can really lead to some low productivity, not by lack of intelligence or effort, but simply by being in those environments. And
by that demand, yeah.
Yes.
In doing cross-cultural work for a lot of my academic career, at least, I always try to pay attention to like the long drag of history, right? Because there's such a motivation, at least politically, to say we're done with that. Yes,
oh, yes.
We've achieved women's lib, or yes, we've achieved racial equity. I think what you're saying is like the automatic reaction in a household under stress because of pandemic conditions is to snap back what we've always known culturally, which is to put the onus of responsibility and leadership and how to on a woman versus a male in a household where both exist.
And then you hear the line of reasoning, I can only do one thing at a time. I'm not mentioning any names, but someone I know.
You know who you
and
are.
Love. might kind of be that way. And so there's this immense focus. And so sure, maybe it is that we're kind of regressing or going where it's comfortable, what we've known, to kind of cope with things, for sure.
Yeah, there's some great quotes out of liberation psychology that talk about, you know, the only mode of leadership that the oppressed know is the dictator, because it's all they've known for many generations. And so, you know, I don't think we know how many generations of change it takes before the reflex is to snap back to past harms.
I agree. And that's interesting you bring that up, because the more that I read, the more I think, oh, wait, this didn't start at 1900. I've been focusing on the progressive movement, right?
Yeah.
It didn't start then. We have to go back another generation. And then there's Civil War. And then before that. And so you're right. It's constantly kind of looking back, but then also trying to develop a long perspective of how things have evolved and how they might be trending.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the piece of this for the current pandemic conditions that I really feel distressed about in this moment is, so we know from data that productivity is actually up being sequestered at home. Right?
Really?
So work from home productivity has risen. You're expertly describing these conditions that often automatically fall or too automatically fall on the woman. It makes a lot of sense then that the women might be the ones to opt out of the workforce given those conditions.
It does. It does. And also on the other side of that coin is this idea that I need to constantly remind how much my husband does. Mm-hmm. So that I can't just go, you know, but yeah. Yeah, it's just very hard to manage all of that.
Yeah.
And the reason that the productivity is higher, I'm wondering if it isn't because there's no shutoff valve. We're 24/7 on. We're working all the time. I find myself checking my email, and I finally told everybody in my department at our Christmas meeting in December, I said, we've got to stop doing that. And if we're trying to help our students by responding quickly, but here's what we're doing. We're setting up another generation of people in the human services field to burn out. Because we're emulating what we don't want them to do. And so we have got to, you know, be aware of that.
I'm giving you applause right now via Zoom. Yeah. And so to finish up that thought that I said before is that the same erasing of history that you're exposing through your research and writing on these women, the danger is that that's happening again today.
Yeah.
That the story, it's so easy for us to tell the story of women opting out of the workplace as, oh, look, they love staying at home, or, and it's like, no, this is a story of great distress.
Right.
This is a story of people, women, making these decisions because of hardship. And it's going to be so easy for us to write the story in a more positive way, which is what we've always tended to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important. You got me riled up again, Sarah.
Oh, good.
I think your work is really important for today because we need to learn from that history. We need the constant reminder that we need accuracy in the telling of stories of everyone, right? And so this conversation is about the telling of stories about women in the modern age during a pandemic. And on another episode, I've done an episode on issues of transgender people in the workplace. That's a story that we can't forget, right? And that's a story that has equally as long of a history as the one that we're telling today. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things when we set up the journal, and we talked about this on, I think, on episode 3 with Dr. Jose Domine, is that I'm interested in historical articles for the journal as a research article, and how too often our field forgets to recognize that historical documentation is a valid and important aspect of academic scholarship. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm cheering you on because, of course, that's kind of my bias. That's what I've been doing. You know, looking at history too, in terms of these discrete linear events, from doing this reading, I may find, oh, but look over here, we had an influencer from economics. Over here, we had an influencer from social psychology. Over here, we had a vocifer. And so, but yet you can't really say this is your one role. Mm. These women had multiple roles. And so in that sense, we are not that much different from today than back then. And so we can learn a lot from that, you know, and try not to make the same, that corneal phrase, try not to make those same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah.
History repeating itself. Yeah. But I agree. I think that it's really important to know where you come from so that you have more foresight and you're able to see around corners. That just helps make a stronger field, I think, and better theories and better applications. So
let's help our listeners then know how to access your work. I've read one article of yours so far, but can you talk about, I think you have a series of articles set up. Can you talk about sort of what's happening? And then we'll at the end plug in, and I'll put it in the show notes, will be able to find your work in the future. So tell us about this series that you're doing first, if you would.
So for right now, I've started out with a series on a lot of the research I've done. I did kind of my own little white paper that I haven't published or anything, but just kind of cataloging and each individual woman. And now I'm kind of going back and noting the intersections of their work. And so that's given, as I build on it, it's given me a bigger picture of what went on. But currently I have an article in Career Convergence, and then I have it's part of a series on early women visionaries, pioneers in the field. And the article that's coming out in, what month are we in? In March, will be on vocifers primarily. Of course, we know about Lucinda Wyman Prince, who worked with Parsons Bureau, but we don't know so much about the other folks. So I have an article coming out about that. And I believe then there will be another one after that, also in Career Convergence. So that's that online magazine through Career Development Association.
Yeah. So this is NCDA, National Career Development Association. It's the Career Convergence magazine. I know that members receive a prompt for it in email.
Yes.
Is that open source to non-members? I'm not sure if you know that.
I wondered that the other day too, because I'm automatically signed in.
Yeah.
So
something to look for, or maybe a reason for our listeners to join NCDA if they're not members. And so it sounds like this is going to be a three-part series. Part one came out in January, if I remember correctly. And these are columns, right? It's more like reading a newspaper-length column, article-type column, than like a research article. Well, it is a research article, but not like a research journal article, not like a book.
These are written for the career practitioner, really.
Right. Yeah.
And so kind of, piece to that too, is what can we learn from this in our application today? So that's always going to be a piece of each article as well.
Very good. And do you have any other outlets for this work that you're thinking about in the future that we might look out for, or are the columns as much as you can muster during the, it's probably a bad time to ask you that question now that I've said it.
Right. My pandemic gray hair is coming out and my children. Oh my gosh. But no, I'm looking forward to more outlets. I thought this would be a good way just to get it out there and let their voices be heard, really, from all the great things that they contributed to where we are now.
Yeah. And so just real quick, before we sign off, I don't know if you have it in front of you or if you can do it from your mind. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but like, could you just sort of name, we've talked about some of the specific women, but could you name some of the women that we might want to Google or learn more about
as
career development practitioners? Who could we learn about?
Absolutely. Well, I've got partial list here. I've got Sophonisba Breckenridge, and that's spelled a little bit different than one of our seminal authors spells it. It's actually spelled Breckinridge. And she worked with Talbot and Edith Abbott at the University of Chicago. We have and authored several books. We have Edith Campbell, who was a Cincinnati Vote Bureau person. We have some activists, Catherine Filene and Ellen Gates Starr. Oh, Henry Alice would have been another one. And she emigrated from Australia. A lot of emigrated people in the field contributed, really. Hollingworth, I mentioned her in the first article because her statistics were great. And she was normal bell curve. And at the time, I believe it was Cattell who made a very interesting comment about her work. And it wasn't so nice.
It was sexist, I'm assuming?
Yes, it was sexist. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there was a lot of discrediting. But anyway. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot. And Anna Reed, of course. Emily Robeson was Cleveland Vogue Bureau. And then several people wrote guides. And even Ruth Mary Weeks, who wrote the authored the People's School, really was integral in pulling in vocational education in the schools. So,
and so for our listeners out there, I just want to make the programming note, like there's no shame in the game of not knowing these names. Right?
Exactly. I mean,
these names have not been included in our history. I would say Anne Rowe is probably the most common early name in the field in a typical
Myers-Briggs.
Yeah, in a typical career textbook. I can't remember off the top of my head. Who was the woman that Don Super's theoretical framework was based off of?
Charlotte Buehler.
Charlotte Buehler. She's awesome. Yeah. And Charlotte Buehler. So, you know, it's okay to not know. Now that you know we don't know, Dr. Sarah Patterson-Mills is giving us a great opportunity to learn more through her work and through her postings on NCDA through Career Convergence. Do you do social media or have a website or anything that you'd want to point listeners to so they can follow you personally?
I have a LinkedIn site.
Okay. And so I will put the...
And it's under Sarah Patterson-Mills.
And I will put that in the show notes so that people can find you easily. And I can just say that... you've been such a delightful colleague for me to know for these past, I guess, 10 plus years, and have always tolerated my shenanigans well. So it's been a real pleasure to have
you
on. Gotta
love shenanigans, yes.
And I'm so deeply appreciative that you are stepping up to do this work and to really recognize all these amazing contributions.
Well, thank you. It's been fun. I enjoy it.
And so for now, this is Global Career Guy, Dr. Brian Hutchison, signing off. Until our next episode, everyone out there, take care and be well.